like the body of a fish. Pitching up and down as the horse runs, it offers little for the jockey to grab to avoid plunging to the ground and under the horse's hooves. Race riding is exceptionally exhausting. It is common for aspiring jockeys to be so rubber-legged upon dismounting from their first circuit around the track that they are unable to walk back to the barn. Strength is not just a tool for winning, it is necessary for survival. Jockey Johnny Longdon was once rammed in mid-race, knocked from his stirrups, and sent flying downward in front of a pack of horses. He was saved by a jockey riding alongside him, George Taniguchi, who was so powerful that he was able to catch Longdon with one hand. Taniguchi didn't know his own strength, and in attempting to push Longdon back into the saddle, he instead hurled him right over the back of his horse. Longdon found himself in the same predicament on the other side of his mount until jockey Rogelio Trejos, whose horse was about to run Longdon down, lunged forward, snagged the jockey with the ease of an outfielder, and righted him in the saddle, also with one hand. Incredibly, Longdon won the race. The Daily Racing Form called it the ultimate impossibility. A jockey is no mere passenger on a racehorse. His role in bringing home winners is critical and demanding. First, jockeys must have an exquisitely fine sense of pace over each furlong, or eighth of a mile. Strategy is crucial. Front runners have the best chance of winning if they set moderate or slow fractional times, leaving themselves the energy to fend off closers, while closers have the best chance of winning if they lag behind a brisk pace, then swoop around the exhausted front runners in the home stretch. The difference between a fast fraction and a slow fraction is often less than a second, and a jockey must be able to discriminate between the two to place his horse optimally. Great jockeys have a freakish talent for gauging pace to within 2 or 3/5 of a second of the actual time and, if asked, can reliably gallop a horse over a distance at precisely the clip requested. Positioning relative to the field is also critical. A racehorse is an enormous creature who needs a wide berth, and as he weighs half a ton and carries 100-plus pounds on his back, he cannot afford to have his momentum stopped or acceleration wasted. Running wide around turns offers the best chance of clear sailing, but exacts a high price in extra distance the horse has to cover. In a big field, jockeys who opt to go wide may have to swing as many as 10 paths out, forcing their horses to run roughly 10 lengths farther than horses on the rail. The best riders take the inside route whenever possible, but this is risky. Because everyone wants to be there, horses usually bunch up by the rail so closely that hips and shoulders rub and stirrups clink off each other, making maneuvering difficult or impossible. Tiring pace setters generally slow down right in front of the rail running pack, compounding the traffic jams. To judge whether or not he's likely to get pocketed if he steers his horse to the rail, a jockey must be able to read the subtleties in the stances of horses and riders in front. The tautness in the reins, the height of the jockey over the saddle, the crispness and cadence of the stride, to gauge how much gas is left in the tank. Doing homework is imperative. Some runners habitually drift in or out in the home stretch or on turns, and the jockey who can arm himself with this knowledge and position himself on the rail behind such a horse can ensure himself a clear path of escape. He must also have the instinct to judge whether or not a hole opening in front of him will stay open long enough to get through, if the space is wide enough, and if his horse has the acceleration to get to it before it slams shut. If he judges it correctly, he can save ground and win a race. If he misjudges it, he may end up fouling other horses and being disqualified, checking his horse sharply and sacrificing his momentum or even falling. Requiring that its human competitors straddle erratic animals moving in dense groups at extremely high speed, race riding in the 1930s, as today, was fraught with extreme danger. Riders didn't even have to leave the saddle to be badly hurt. Their hands and shins were smashed, and their knee ligaments ripped when horses twisted beneath them or banged into rails and walls. Their ankles were crushed when their feet became caught in the starter's webbing. With the advent of the first primitive, unpadded starting gates in the early 30s, some riders actually died in the saddle, speared into the exposed steel overhead bars by rearing horses. Riders suffered horrible injuries when dragged from their stirrups and under their horses' legs, or when thrown forward, ending up clinging to the underside of the horses' necks, while the animals' front legs pummeled their chests and abdomens. The only thing more dangerous than being on the back of a racehorse was being thrown from one. Some jockeys took 200 or more falls in their careers. Some were shot into the air when horses would prop or plant their front hooves and slow abruptly. Others went down when their mounts would bolt, crashing into the rail or even the grandstand. A common accident was clipping heels, in which trailing horses tripped over leading horses' hind hooves, usually sending the trailing horse and rider into a somersault. Finally, horses could break down, racing's euphemism for incurring leg injuries. This could happen without warning, sending the victim pitching headfirst into the ground. A rider who lost touch with the saddle became a projectile moving at 60 feet per second, and whatever he hit became a potentially lethal instrument. If he was lucky enough to survive the impact with the ground, and possibly his horse's falling body, he often had trailing horses, their hooves striking the ground with as much as 3,000 pounds of force, bearing down on him. In the worst cases, a single faller could trigger a chain reaction pileup onto a downed jockey. Serious insults to the body, the kind of shattering or crushing injury seen in high-speed auto wrecks, are an absolute certainty for every single jockey. Today, the Jockeys Guild, which covers riders in the United States, receives an average of 2,500 injury notifications per year, with 2 deaths and 2.5 cases of paralysis. The Guild is currently supporting 50 riders who were permanently disabled on the job. According to a study by the Rehabilitation Institute of Chicago, each year, the average jockey is injured 3 times and spends a total of almost 8 weeks sidelined by injuries incurred on the track. Nearly 1 in every 5 injuries is to the head or neck. A 1993 survey found that 13% of jockeys suffered concussions over a period of just 4 months. Injury rates were, by all accounts, far higher in the 1920s and 1930s. Between 1935 and 1939 alone, 19 riders were killed in racing accidents. The hell-for-leather riding tactics practiced in the era and the absence of protective gear increased the vulnerability of race riders to mortal injury. Today, races are filmed from multiple angles to ensure safe riding. Jockeys wear flak jackets, goggles, and high-tech helmets and compete at tracks equipped with safety rails and ambulances that trail the field around the track. No such luxuries were available to the jockeys of the 20s and 30s. At best, only 1 or 2 stewards monitored riding tactics. A jockey's only bodily protection was a skullcap constructed of silk-covered cardboard. Former jockey Morris Griffin, who was paralyzed in a 1946 racing fall, likened his headgear to a yarmulke. Lacking a chin strap, it usually popped off before the wearer slammed into the ground. Cutting out the lining and crown to lower their riding weight, most jockeys rendered the skullcap useless. Once riders were down on the course, tracks had virtually no protocol for coping with their injuries. Riders were lucky if someone rounded up a car to get them to a hospital, and since virtually none of them had any money or insurance, they were likely to be turned away from any hospital to which they were taken. Track officials appeared to feel little obligation to them. In 1927, best friends Tommy Luther and Earl Sandy Graham were slated to ride a pair of stablemates in the same race at Winnipeg's Polo Park. Luther was assigned to a lumbering, uncoordinated colt named Vesper Lad, while Graham was up on Irish Princess II. At the last minute, the trainer reversed the assignments. While Luther was hustling Irish Princess to the lead, he heard a gasp from the crowd. He finished the race, then pivoted in the saddle to see what had happened. He saw Graham lying motionless on the track. Vesper Lad had rammed into the rail, dropping Graham to the track, where he had been trampled by the field. His ribs and back were shattered. Track officials carried Graham up to the jockey's room and dumped him on a saddle table, where he lay moaning and incoherent. It had been decided that Graham could wait until after the races, when it was most convenient for someone to drop him by the hospital. Luther and the other jockeys were not permitted to leave the jockey's room to take him in themselves. Had they done so, they would have lost their jobs and housing. Though Luther passed the hat to raise cab fare to send him on alone, the jockeys didn't have enough money among them. Luther spent the afternoon sitting with Graham, offering him water and pleading in vain with officials to get the boy to the hospital. Finally, after the races were over, Graham was taken to the hospital, where Luther sat by his bed. The race season soon ended, and Luther was forced to leave his friend's side to accompany his trainer to another track. A few days later, Graham died. He was only 16. His death was little noticed. Jockey fatalities were so common that they rarely earned more than a slim paragraph in the press. The only person left in town to mourn for Graham was a woman the writers called Mother Harrison, operator of a Turkish bath that Graham and Luther had frequented. She buried the boy, but couldn't afford a headstone. Luther mailed what little money he could spare to Mother Harrison to buy a grave marker. With the leftover money, she bought a small bouquet of flowers and laid it on the boy's grave. She drew a picture of the grave and mailed it to Luther. 70 years later, Luther still has the drawing. The racetrack casualty list was full of stories of the cruel, the bizarre, and the miraculous. In 1938, leading Agua Caliente jockey Charlie Rosengarten gave up the mount on the favorite Toro Mac to a struggling rider named Jimmy Sullivan, who needed the money to feed his wife and newborn baby. Rosengarten watched in horror as Toro Mac, sailing toward a sure victory, inexplicably crossed his forelegs and fell, crushing Sullivan to death. After a spill that knocked him unconscious, face down in a puddle, Eddie Arcaro would have become the first jockey in history to drown on the job had a photographer not rushed out from the stands and turned his head to allow him to breathe. Steve Donahue, who rode in Europe and the United States in the interwar years, was once on a horse that clipped heels and fell, spilling him onto the track in front of a mob of onrushing horses. He was an instant from being trampled to death when an elderly woman suddenly materialized out of nowhere, grabbed hold of him, and dragged him under the rail. She left him in the safety of the infield and vanished. Donahue never saw her again. But nothing tops the strange fate of Ralph Neves, a hard-headed, hard-riding teenaged jockey known as the Portuguese Pepperpot. One afternoon in May of 1936, driving a filly around the far turn of California's Bay Meadows racecourse, Neves was on the lead and looking like a cinch to win. But without warning, the horse stumbled and crashed. Flipping to the track, Neves was trampled by trailing horses. The filly rose, uninjured. Neves had evidently broken her fall, but the jockey lay motionless. Two physicians in the crowd sprinted out to him, joining the track doctor. Neves was not breathing and his heart had stopped. They declared him dead on the track. The race caller made the somber announcement and asked the crowd to stand in prayer. As the sickened spectators bent their heads and reporters rushed to get word to their editors, Neves's body was carried into the track infirmary and parked on a table. According to one report, his boot was pulled off and his toe was tagged. Between 10 and 20 minutes later, with Neves's body already growing cold, the track physician decided to take a shot at the moon and injected Neves's heart with adrenaline. Neves woke up. He asked the physician if he had won the fifth race. The stunned doctor told him the fifth hadn't been run yet. Neves promptly stood up and announced that he had to get back to riding. The physician refused to let him go and rushed the uncooperative jockey to a hospital in San Mateo, where attendants tried to hold him for observation. Neves, still fixated on riding the rest of the card, bolted from his gurney and made a run for it. Hospital staffers chased him outside, snagged him, and pulled him back in, but Neves soon broke loose again, made it out the door, leaped into a cab, and rode back to Bay Meadows. Once at the track, he jumped out and began rushing toward the jockey's room. As the shirtless, blood-spattered erstwhile corpse sprinted past the grandstand, astonished fans started running after him. By the time Nevis hit the wire, most of the crowd was chasing him, evidently hopped up on the adrenaline injection. Nevis shook loose from the mob, dashed past the clubhouse, and burst into the jockey's room. He scared the bejesus out of everyone. When the jockeys recovered from the shock, they took Nevis, kicking and screaming, down to the first aid room. He insisted that he was going to ride his one remaining mount. The incredulous stewards refused and insisted that he return to the hospital. Nevis refused. He came back the next day, loaded for bear. While San Franciscans were reading his obituary in several papers, the decidedly undead Nevis rode like a man possessed, finishing second or third on all five of his mounts. Reports of his death were 59 years premature. A sideline jockey was a forgotten jockey. Because of this cold reality, most jockeys would ride through virtually anything, and they shrugged off the grisliest injuries. "I got my leg broken once, and my skull fractured once," said former rider Wad Studley. "But never nothing bad." Johnny Longdon once won a major race while riding with broken bones in his back and foot. When a colt named Daddy Longlegs bolted for the closed paddock gate, sailed over it upside down and landed on top of him, Steve Donahue simply strapped his broken wrist bones together with cloth and rode one-handed. On another occasion, his boot caught in the stirrup as he fell off, causing him to be dragged by his foot down the track. His head bumped along beside his filly's thrashing legs until his leg snapped and his foot came free. Not wanting to give up his mount in an upcoming race, Donahue drove to the stables, had himself carried to his horse, and rode every day with a bulky plaster cast on his leg. Most incredibly, he rode for a full year with serious internal injuries incurred when another horse spiked him into the ground. Though he knew he had been critically injured, he refused treatment and grew weaker and weaker until someone finally took him to a doctor. The moment he entered the office, he fainted into his physician's arms. He was rushed to emergency surgery and barely survived. The motivation for riding through such pain soon became all too clear. While still hospitalized, he was summarily fired by his contract trainer. Finally, jockeys would not allow themselves to admit to their injuries because that would open the door to their ultimate enemy, fear. To acknowledge pain was to acknowledge danger. In their line of work, fear had a physical presence. Once a jockey let it into his head, it would rise up over him on the track, paralyzing him. Winning jockeys are daring jockeys, capable of gunning a horse through the narrowest hole with damn the torpedoes bravado. Frightened jockeys take what Luther called the married man's route, timidly detouring around the outside of the pack. No one would hire a man who hesitated in the heat of battle. Jockeys could smell fear in one of their own and would exploit it mercilessly, trying to intimidate their way past a rival. "If a jock showed even the slightest trace of cowardice," wrote Orcaro, "it could get awfully rough out there." As a result, jockeys never, ever spoke about danger, pain, or fear, even among themselves. In conversation, they papered over the grim realities of their jobs with cheery euphemisms. Hideous wrecks were referred to as spills. Jockeys hurled into the ground were unseated. In their autobiographies, they recounted great races in intimate detail, but falls and injuries were glossed over with the most perfunctory language. Even in the grip of agonizing pain or complete debilitation, most jockeys clung to their illusion of invulnerability. For some, fear had a way of breaking through the illusion. "You didn't talk about it," remembered Farrell Jones, a jockey tough enough to earn the nickname Wild Horse. "I thought about it. I don't know if any of them other guys did, but I did. It was spooky." Even Arcaro, one of the most daring riders, admitted that the memory of his first spill in which a horse stepped on his back and another kicked his skull, leaving him with a concussion, two fractured ribs, and a punctured lung, was seared into his memory and burned there for the rest of his career. It was, he wrote, a terrifying experience that somehow cannot be blotted out. For riders' families, the danger and injuries took their toll. In dreams, Helen Luther saw her husband's death play itself out countless times. In murky images, his horse would spiral into the ground, carrying Tommy under him, and Helen would wake into a life striated with fear. Helen watched Tommy ride every day. She was a rarity in the sport. The vast majority of jockeys' wives couldn't stand to watch their husbands' races and rarely, if ever, came to the track. Helen missed only one ride. On that day, a horse named Bricktop speared Tommy's head into the steel overhead beam of the starting gate. He lay on the ground, his skull cap split, refusing to let the attendants take him to the hospital. "My wife will be here," he kept repeating, sure that Helen was up in the stands. Helen didn't come, and though Tommy recovered, she never ceased regretting it. Forever after, Helen was there, her eyes trained on every move of her husband's horses. She was frightened for every minute of his career. Sometime early in her marriage, Helen began a ritual. Each time his mount left the paddock and set his first forehoof onto the track, she would pray that the horse would see him home safely. Helen's prayers failed Tommy on a rain-drenched July afternoon at Empire City. He was a 1/16 of a mile away from winning a race when the filly he was riding abruptly tripped over her own legs and plunged headfirst into the track. Helen saw her husband ride the arc of the filly's back down into the mud and disappear under her tumbling body and the bodies of the three horses who struck her from behind. Their hooves cracked into Tommy's head as they fell. Helen never knew how she got from the grandstand to the track. Her mind drummed, "He is under all those horses." The next thing she recalled, she was standing over her husband. She was sure he was dead. They carried Tommy into the first aid room on a stretcher. His ancient valet, Johnny Mitchell, bent over him, his tears falling onto Tommy's cheeks as he gently sponged the mud and blood away. Helen stood back and stared at her husband. He didn't move. Helen was seized in violent tremors, and her teeth chattered uncontrollably. She heard someone say, "This woman is in shock," and felt someone slip a brandy into her hand. She refused it. The man who fetched it, badly shaken, drank it himself. They loaded Tommy into an ambulance and drove him toward St. John's Hospital. Helen was left alone to find her own way there. She got into Tommy's car and drove around New York, confused by the unfamiliar streets. The fuel gauge read empty, so she pulled over at a gas station. The attendant hooked up her car to the pump and came over to chat with her. "Isn't it too bad?" he said. "Tommy Luther was killed." Helen whirled in panic. She didn't know what to do or where to go. She briefly thought she should go back to the track. She changed her mind and went toward the hospital. Somehow, she found it. She ran in. Tommy was still alive. Helen nearly collapsed. Tommy survived. He would have no short-term memory for several days and no depth perception for 6 months. He staggered like a drunk for a good while. But he would ride for 20 more years, bearing only a single scar from a hoof. Helen went back to their lodgings alone. It was a rental house in Yonkers, one of countless, faceless rental places she lived in for decades, like nearly all jockeys' wives. You never stayed long enough to get a pet or a houseplant or hang any paintings. The neighbors sneered at you, knowing that you were racetrack people. Helen once found a burglar hiding beneath her bed in a rental place, but the neighbors didn't respond to her screams because they assumed that screaming was the normal mode of discourse for racetrackers. Always, on nights returning alone, there were worries about practical matters. A jockey's pay couldn't begin to cover the sky-high insurance rates his job warranted, much less the doctor's bills. Track officials viewed any effort to create funds for injured riders as unionizing, and they were ready to ban any jockey who took steps in that direction. So jockeys went without insurance and made do with what they had, passing the hat when one of their colleagues went down. Women like Helen could only hope there would be enough. Helen ran to the front door, jammed the key in, and rushed inside. The empty house frightened her, and she nearly fainted when the landlord's parrot spoke to her in the dark. She went upstairs and locked herself in the bathroom. "If I didn't have him," she said as her mind rolled back over that night, "I was alone." Red Pollard and George Wolfe had signed on to a life that used men up. But for all its miseries, there was an unmistakable allure to the jockey's craft, one that both found irresistible. Man is preoccupied with freedom, yet laden with handicaps. The breadth of his activity and experience is narrowed by the limitations of his relatively weak, sluggish body. The racehorse, by virtue of his awesome physical gifts, freed the jockey from himself. When a horse and a jockey flew over the track together, there were moments in which the man's mind wedded itself to the animal's body to form something greater than the sum of both parts. The horse partook of the jockey's cunning. The jockey partook of the horse's supreme power. For the jockey, the saddle was a place of unparalleled exhilaration, of transcendence. "The horse," recalled one rider, "he takes you." Aboard a racehorse, in full stride, wrote Steve Donahue, "I am so completely in the race that I forget the crowds. My horse and I talk together. We don't hear anyone else." At the bottom of the depression, when wrenching need narrowed the parameters of experience as never before, the liberation offered by the racehorse was, to young men like Pollard and Wolfe, a siren song. On the ground, the jockey was fettered and muted, moving in slow motion, the world a sensory vacuum after the tenfold high of racing speed. In the saddle, emancipated from their bodies, Pollard, Wolfe, and all other reinsmen sailed 8 feet over the world, emphatically free, emphatically alive. They were Hemingway's bullfighters, living all the way up. Chapter 6. Light and Shadow. Sooner or later, just about all the Bug Boys went up the hill. When they began the journey the first time, following the narrow dirt road that turned up from the racetrack, they probably looked very young and somewhat breathless. When they came back, they were half a dollar poorer, 20 minutes older, and decidedly more swaggering at the walk, and the stories they could tell. At the top of the hill, as everyone knew, stood the big cinder block building that stared down on the track at Tijuana, or Tijuana, as they called it. The building was the home of the Molino Rojo, or Red Mill, a shag-carpeted shrine to the world's oldest profession. It was by far the largest house of prostitution in the world, and probably the most successful. Hovering right over the old Tijuana track, consuming half a city block, topped by an immense spinning windmill and decked out in flashing red lights that were visible clear across the border, the Molino Rojo must have been to the racetrackers what the North Star was to the Magi. It took effort for the riders to avoid looking right at it every time they rode in morning workouts or circled the barn walking hots. The jockeys called it the House of the Wilted Pigeons. The Molino Rojo had no madam. The girls ran the place themselves, and they did so with the cunning of robber barons. It was no surprise to them that half the people at the racetrack were unsupervised hell-raisers gripped in the ferocious throes of puberty. Surely it was more than a happy coincidence that the price of admission, 50 cents straight up, remembers one former Bug Boy, was precisely equal to the pay for galloping a horse. Any rider who made it up the hill had his beer paid for, compliments of the house. And in the unlikely event that a lad wasn't quite in the mood, he would be ushered into the house theater to be inspired by an exotic blue movie. There were so many girls to choose from, every conceivable nationality, that a kid would have to gallop 300 horses to afford them all. He could walk down the long, narrow halls, off of which were countless, fabulously appointed bedrooms, listen to the girls beckoning in soft Spanish, and simply take his pick. "You went through there," remembers one client, "like you were going through a grocery store." The girls took customer service seriously. Velvet Tongue de Velma and Chichi Grande needed no introduction. A girl the riders called One Wing Annie did a brisk business despite missing one arm. One girl told a bug boy that if he could track down $5, she'd show him something he'd never forget. $5 was the kind of money you could live on for a week back then. But practical considerations were unlikely to occur to a bug boy in such a situation. Within moments, a herd of jockeys packed into a room at the mill and showered $5 worth of nickels and dimes on the girl in question. She promptly stripped naked, lit up a cigarette, and blew smoke rings from a place into which only a creative-minded and supple-bodied prostitute would think of placing a cigarette. It was the greatest day of the bug boys' lives. "What talent!" recalled a witness. "Of course I had to change my brand of cigarettes after that." The Molino Rojo set the standard for Tijuana. The jockeys lived high and hard, riding by day, roaming the town in dense, noisy scrums by night, pouring into the Molino Rojo, then the Turf Club Saloon, then on to wild exploits in town, chasing giggling girls buck-naked down motel corridors, stealing all the room keys to the town's biggest hotel. Among the riders were Red Pollard and George Wolfe. It was to this strangely bountiful place that they came each winter, and they thought of it as home. Riding there from fall to spring every year, they defined themselves as athletes and as men. In 1928, their first full season together, they took the racing world by storm. Settling into his niche as a miracle worker for tough and neurotic horses, Pollard earned assignments on nearly 300 mounts and guided them to more than $20,000 in total purse earnings. His 53 winners placed him in a tie for 20th in winning percentage among fully employed riders in North America, those with 100 or more mounts. He was a complete success. But Wolf was supernatural. Though in the big leagues only a few months, Wolf was signed on to ride more than 550 mounts, many of whom were stakes horses of the highest quality, and won with more than 100 of them for total purse earnings of $100,000. His winning average of 19% ranked him in a tie for 16th among fully employed riders. As the weekday wonder and the money man, Pollard and Wolf established themselves in the uppermost tier of North American racing. They also carved out their own respective roles in the social world. Pollard, with his books, his stories, and his offbeat sense of humor, earned the bewildered affection of everyone at the track. A small cadre of racetrack eccentrics gathered around him. In the jockey's room, he orchestrated a string of clever practical jokes, sequestered himself in corners to pore over literature, and mystified his fellow jocks with aphorisms from Omar Khayyam and old Waldo Emerson. A passing incident might inspire him to gallop through huge sections of Shakespeare, committed to memory, leaving the bug boys furrowing their brows. His language was a patchwork of cultivated speech and blue-streak profanity. He was loved for his wicked humor, delivered with a Buster Keaton straight face and boundless generosity. He was feared and admired for his fist-fighting skills, drop-of-a-hat volatility, thundering bass voice, and daring. He was a prolific yarn spinner. One tale featured Pollard riding racehorses for Tsar Nicholas. He could slip this one past the bug boys, who hadn't gone to school long enough to know that the Bolsheviks had put an end to poor Nicholas when Pollard was only 9. Another favorite described how he inadvertently bedded down beside 5 hibernating bears in a Canadian cave. Hair grew on this story until the bears were wide awake and the ex-boxer was using his deadly left hook to knock all 5 unconscious. When he wasn't telling stories, he was smart-assing racing officials. He once attended a racing banquet at which a racing starter was the keynote speaker. The starter was notorious for his profanity, specifically his trademark phrase, "Put a twitch on that son of a bitch," referring to a restraint device that was pulled over horses' upper lips to distract them while they were being loaded into the gate. As the host droned through the starter's introduction, Pollard fidgeted in the crowd, slurping up champagne and, like everyone else, stagnating in boredom. As the starter rose to speak, clearing his throat for effect, Pollard abruptly stood up. "Put a twitch on that son of a bitch," he boomed. In the rough-and-tumble world of the track, Pollard was something of a sheriff. Farrell Jones, who rode alongside Pollard, recalled a fight he got into with a veteran jockey in a dispute over a checkers match. When Jones won the match, the older jockey flipped the board across the room and promptly tackled him. Jones, who was only 13 and weighed a little more than 80 pounds, quickly found himself on the losing end of the tussle. The older jockey pounded him mercilessly and tried to jam his thumbs into his eyes. Pollard swept up to them, grabbed the attacking jockey by the back of the neck, tossed him to the ground, and pinned him. Pressing the jockey to the floor, he pinched his nose between his fingers and twisted it. The jockey howled for mercy. After letting him squirm for a while, Pollard released the rider, who had blood running from his nose and tears streaming down his face. "Don't you ever touch that kid again," Pollard hissed. He stalked off, leaving the room in silence. Nobody ever messed with Red. If Pollard was the jester, Wolf was the king. The crowds adored him, shouting, "Ride him, cowboy!" as he powered down the stretch on his good luck piece, a battered kangaroo leather saddle once carried by Far Lap, the greatest racehorse in Australian history. The press doted on him. The Lost Boys of the racetrack worshipped him. Wolf took them under his wing, letting them co-pilot his roadster and teaching them the fine arts of horsemanship. After winning races, he'd drive over to the backstretch and stuff cash into the pockets of his mount's grooms. He chaperoned groups of riders on mornings of road work, but by the end of the run, discipline always seemed to break down and he'd end up jogging them into a gin joint to refill their depleted systems with a tall one. To help some of them conceal their big feet and their coming growth spurts, Wolf started up a black market in his shoes. Riders all over the backstretch balled up their toes, wadded them into Wolf's hand-me-down silver inlaid boots, which, to their misery, were pointed, and limped around in them all day. A jockey's feet might bleed, but donning Wolf's shoes was an honor. Horseman Harold Washburn's boyhood memory of his first sight of Wolf sums up the impression the Iceman left on the kids of the backstretch. "I walked out and see Georgie pull up with that big car with them superchargers on it, step out of that car with them boots with silver inlaid on it, white western hat, and I thought, oh my God, I am gonna be a jockey." Wolf could get away with anything. In the spring of 1932, when a solar eclipse occurred just as he was scheduled to ride to the post, he carried a shaded glass out onto the horse with him, pulled up, lay his head back on his horse's rump, and sat there, gazing at the sun while the crowd stared at him. In winning another race, he rode with such supreme concentration that he didn't notice that he had torn right out of his paper-thin pants. He didn't have a stitch of clothing on underneath, nor did he have the good fortune to at least be trailing the field. By the time he was galloping out, everyone at the track knew what Wolf had not yet noticed. "Hey, Wolf!" came a laughing voice from behind. "You're sticking out!" Wolf cantered the horse back to the cheering grandstand and calmly asked his valet for a saddle towel. The valet trotted up with the requisite fig leaf, and Wolf, smiling out of one side of his mouth, wrapped it around his waist, rode into the winner's circle, and posed for the photo. He hopped down and glided back to the jock's room to a hearty round of applause. Off the track, Wolf steered clear of the town's appeals to vice, preferring late-morning pit stops in Chuck Sloan's restaurant for a complimentary beer and a bowl of turtle soup. Not even the Molino Rojo tempted him. He had better things on his mind. In 1930, while cruising up over the border with Sonny Greenberg, he stopped at a San Ysidro train car diner and fell head over heels in love with a gorgeous 16-year-old waitress named Genevieve. Wolf began coming in regularly, parking his Stetson on the table and pointing Greenberg's nose in the racing form while he romanced her. In 1931, at age 21, Wolf married her. Pollard, a more adventurous soul, probably lived a little closer to the pulse of Tijuana. A romantic, he appears to have passed up the offers from the Tijuana prostitutes. He drank a little with the boys, got into a few fistfights, and lived at the top of his game. It was the happiest time of his life. "How can I keep away from this place?" he would say on a visit 10 years later. "Isn't it my first love?" The halcyon days at the Tijuana track came to a spectacular end. On the backstretch, early each morning, men guided teams of horses on circuits of the barns, shoveling the mucked-out manure into wagons and driving the teams up the hill behind the backstretch, where they would dump it. The pile had been accumulating since 1917, and because the city received little rain to wash it down, it was enormous. "Oh my gosh," remembered trainer Jimmy Jones. "It was as big as the grandstand." Inside its percolating depths, the manure fermented, generating scalding heat. To the locals, the mountain of manure was a steaming eyesore. To the jockeys, it was prime sauna country. Every day, riders dug holes in the surface and burrowed in, Pollard and Wolf probably included. A few took the precaution of zipping into rubber suits before wiggling in, but most just wore street clothes. It was almost too hot to take, but Mother Nature's hotbox proved unbeatable for sweating off weight. The mountain was not long for this world. Sometime in the late 1920s, after extraordinarily heavy rains, swollen streams running off the nearby mountains backed up into a ravine, then exploded over the banks. Howling through Tijuana, the wall of water crashed into the racetrack, hurling houses, barns, and bridges along with it. Grooms ran down the backstretch before the onrushing water, throwing open stall doors and chasing out the horses who scattered in all directions. Behind them, the irresistible force of the flood met the immovable object of the manure pile. The water won. The mound, a marvel of solidity for a decade, was uprooted whole and began to shudder along in one murderous mass. It rolled over the San Diego and Arizona railroad tracks that fed the racetrack, tearing them out. Moving as if animated with destructive desire, it gurgled down the backstretch, banked around the far turn, bore out in the home stretch, and mowed down the entire grandstand. It made a beeline for the Monte Carlo Casino, crashing straight through its walls and cracking it wide open. Then, like a mighty shit Godzilla, it slid out to sea and vanished. For 2 days, the track was underwater, stranding a cluster of grooms and loose horses atop a spit of land. People scurried in and out of what was left of the casino, pushing wheelbarrows brimming with silver dollars scooped up from the opened vaults. As the water subsided, grooms combed the town for the freed horses. Most had vanished in the hills, never to be reclaimed. But one man's loss was another man's gain. Impoverished mountain-dwelling Mexicans, who usually got around on wormy little burros, were soon cantering through town in high style, straddling blue-blooded thoroughbreds worth a lifetime of their income. The Tijuana horsemen, long accustomed to calamity, rode off the horses, picked up and went on. They were racing again in a couple of days. Soon afterward, a new $3 million racetrack called Agua Caliente was built just down the road. The old Tijuana track was reduced to a squatter's haven, and Pollard and Wolf set up shop across town. Wolf immediately ruled the roost at Agua Caliente, riding the best horse at the track, Gallant Sir. He won the 1933 Agua Caliente Handicap, one of the world's most prestigious races. In 1934, Wolf and Gallant Sir were set to defend their title. On the morning of the race, Wolf was scheduled to give the horse a light gallop, but at the appointed hour, The rider was nowhere to be found. Trainer Woody Fitzgerald jumped in his car and drove to Wolf's house. He found the Iceman sprawled across his bed, too absorbed in a cowboy magazine to bother going to his job. Fitzgerald fired him on the spot. Wolf went back to reading. Fitzgerald sped back to the track and began a frantic hunt for a last-minute replacement. Pollard didn't have a mount in the race, so Fitzgerald let him ride. Pollard rode flawlessly and won. Gallant Sir had won more than $23,000 that day, and Pollard's cut was the biggest payday of his life. It was only the third stakes win of Pollard's career, and in a backward kind of way, he owed it to Wolf. It would be 4 years before he was in a position to repay him. The days of large life and uncomplicated success were fleeting. For Wolf, the longest shadow on his life surfaced a few years into his career. Its most evident manifestation seemed innocuous enough. Wolf was prone to nodding off. He would spend his days off stretched out in bed, snoozing. At parties, he was known to fall asleep in mid-conversation. His wife, Genevieve, and his friend Bill Buck were so concerned about his sudden attacks of sleep that they chauffeured him everywhere. Between races, Wolf climbed atop the jockey's lockers and curled up in the arms of Morpheus. He took napping so seriously that he eventually staked out a secret nest on the track roof, tucked in behind a chimney. Roused as the jock's room custodian shouted the traditional pre-race call of, "Jockeys! Jockeys!" Wolf would slip downstairs, wake himself with a tall Coca-Cola spiked with a couple of drops of ammonia, blot his lips, mutter, "Let's go get this money and go home," and stride into battle. To almost everyone in the jockey's room, Wolf's perpetual sleepiness was just another of his many eccentricities. To Wolf, Genevieve, and a few close friends, it meant something entirely different. Insulin-dependent type 1 diabetes. His disease apparently surfaced in 1931, shortly after Caliente opened. Diabetes has never been easy to live with. In the 1930s, it was hellish. Insulin had only been discovered about a decade before Wolf's diagnosis. Glucose levels were monitored by testing urine, which could only measure glucose present in the blood 8 hours earlier. Trial and error was the only method physicians had to figure dosage. Additives had not been developed to improve the absorption of the hormone, and the proper diet for diabetes management was not yet fully understood. As a result, patients like Wolf could never truly control their illness. Giving himself repeated daily shots of canine insulin in the abdomen, arm, or leg, Wolf almost certainly spent his days boomeranging between insulin gluts and deficits. The result was frequent sickness, nausea, vomiting, extreme thirst and hunger, occasional irritability, and exhaustion. It also created a perilous dilemma. Wolf was in a career in which staying light was of paramount importance. He was not a natural lightweight. Fellow jockeys dubbed him Old Lead Pad. This was a problem facing nearly every jockey, but with the onset of his diabetes, Wolf's problems were compounded. In most patients, type 1 diabetes spurs the appetite, sometimes to extremes. Insulin injections encouraged Wolf to gain weight, and to manage his diabetes, he needed to consume regular high-protein, low-carbohydrate meals. Meats were recommended, which also added pounds. Between 1931 and 1932, Wolf's weight jumped by almost 10% to 115, too high to ride most horses. He faced a wrenching conflict. To perform in the sport he was born for, he had to be very thin. But to survive his disease, he had to maintain habits that made thinness virtually impossible. He tried to find a happy medium, taking his insulin regularly, eating thick steaks, and reducing the extra weight off. Genevieve worried about the reducing and tried to stop him, but he appears to have found ways to do it anyway. He was an avid follower of Frenchie Hawley's methods. Though Frenchie's concepts of reducing were in some cases medieval, they were generally safer than those the jockeys dreamed up on their own. So Wolf probably benefited as a result. But his reducing, combined with the blunt instrument character of diabetes treatment in the 1930s, made controlling his blood sugar extremely difficult. At times, He seemed to hover on the edge of passing out. Trainer George Moore remembered that Wolf sometimes rode while appearing strangely ashen, while Wolf's friend Sonny Greenberg recalled incidents in which he found the rider slumped in the jockey's room, too ill to speak. So Wolf made another concession to his disease. He began to restrict his riding to top horses assigned high imposts. Occasionally, as a favor to an old gyp trainer friend, he would agree to ride a cheap horse. Wolf weighed a lot more than the imposts assigned to most of these horses, but somehow he was able to circumvent the rule requiring riders to be within 5 pounds of the assignment. His skills negated the handicap. He once won on a horse carrying 15 pounds more than his impost. But these sojourns on cheap horses were rarities. Usually, he rode only about 4 times a week. Nearly all classy horses, rarely more than one a day. Over the course of a year, he rode 150 to 200 mounts, compared with as many as 1,000 for other top riders. Incredibly, in spite of his small number of total mounts, his soaring win percentage invariably placed him near the top of the national jockey rankings for purse money won. In one season, Eddie Arcaro nosed him out for the money-winning title, but only by riding 3 times as many horses. Wolf took to calling Arcaro the desperate dude. Wolf's habit of minimal riding for maximum purses allowed him to survive as a jockey, but he knew he was walking a very fine line. In his era, even simple lacerations often left diabetics with savage infections that necessitated limb and digit amputations, a consequence of the disease's ravaging effects on circulation and immunity. To minimize the risk of being cut in a spill, he tried to avoid very young, inexperienced horses. On the rare occasions when he rode a green horse, he used a custom-made, reinforced saddle and slip-proof girth. But Wolf knew that infection and amputation were the least of his worries. If he played the balance of diabetes management and reducing wrong, he could faint in the saddle while moving at 40 miles per hour. It was probably the only thing that ever really scared him. At roughly the same time that Wolf started his potentially deadly gamble, Pollard engaged in a gamble of his own. It began with a simple morning workout on a horse whose name has long since been forgotten. As Pollard rode the horse down the track that morning, another horse passed close by. Something, maybe a rock or a clump of dirt, flew up from under the animal's hooves and struck Pollard in the head. In the glimmer of an instant, for the price of a 50-cent galloping fee he was probably never paid, Pollard lost the sight in his right eye forever. Had they known of Pollard's blindness, the stewards would rightly have banned him from racing. With virtually no depth perception and no ability to see horses to his outside, he was far more vulnerable to positioning errors. He could unwittingly charge straight into a wreck. It was an injury that should have ended his career. But Pollard, like Wolf, was not willing to hang it up. If anything, he was bolder than ever in the saddle, either to conceal his blindness or simply because he couldn't see just how close he was cutting it. "Red is not one of our great riders, but the only word he knows is yes," wrote a columnist who didn't know of Pollard's blindness. "He'll try to thread a needle with a horse as the flying field turns down the last bend for home, and you must salute him for his courage, if not his judgment." Pollard took an awesome risk. He kept his blindness secret and kept on riding. Just after Pollard rode Gallant Sir to win the 1934 Aguascalientes Handicap, Mexico banned gambling. The colorful racing world that had spun itself around Tijuana withered and blew off into the sagebrush deserts. Pollard and Wolf returned to the United States, where racing had been re-legalized, and their careers began to diverge. On Christmas Day, 1934, Santa Anita Park opened for the first time. Wolf turned the place upside down, riding an out-of-the-clouds long shot named Azucar, a former steeplechaser, to a smashing victory in the first Santa Anita Handicap. It was one of the greatest rides anyone had ever seen. After Wolf dismounted, Azucar butted him out of the way, ran over a spectator, slashed the NBC radio wire, cutting off the national broadcast, and dragged his terrified groom down the track like a toboggan. The Iceman watched him go from the winner's circle a floral wreath wrapped around his shoulders, smiling his cool Gary Cooper smile as a mob of admirers cheered for him. The Iceman had arrived. As Wolfe ascended, Pollard began to fail. Perhaps his partial blindness was the reason. After Gallant Sir, he didn't ride another stakes winner for years. Then even his modest weekday mounts began losing. He moved around North America, through Chicago, New York, Canada, riding the tough horses, the sour ones, and the nervous ones, but his statistics continued to slip. Somewhere along the way, Pollard crossed paths with a jockey agent named Yummy, a round, toad-eyed, linty man, built low. Yummy had a pronounced hare lip that slurred his speech badly. He raised his voice to a pounding level to compensate, but this only made people cringe. He kept his cash in his shoe and lived year-round in the Turkish baths of whatever city he happened through. Like Pollard, he seemed to have lost the need to belong to any place in particular. The best Yummy could do for Pollard was chase his hopelessly beaten mounts down the grandstand rail, hollering and frightening spectators. But he was fanatically loyal. And he had a car. The two began kicking around the country together. In August 1936, they turned up at Ohio's Thistledown Park. Any hopes Pollard had of redeeming himself there were quickly silenced. His win percentage dropped to a lamentable 6%. He rode, on average, fewer than 2 winners a month. Around the track, people whispered that he was finished. He was drifting into the great slipstream in which many promising jockeys are lost. Their talents never tried, for lack of the skilled trainer, the wise owner, the big horse. On August 16th, Pollard and Yummy climbed into Yummy's car, pulled out of the track, and hit the highway. Somewhere along the way, they smacked the car into something. Whatever it was they hit, it didn't have a lot of give to it. The car was showered all over the road. They bailed out into blistering heat. There, beside the hulk of the ruined car, countless miles from anywhere, Pollard was standing in a metaphor for his own life. At 26, he was frightened and empty. The car was totaled, the money was gone, and there were no prospects ahead of him. He and Yummy picked through the wreckage for their most essential belongings, 27 cents and a half pint of a foul brandy they called Bow Wow Wine. Pollard probably salvaged his books and his rosary. There was a sugar cube kicking around in his pocket. They abandoned the car and hung their thumbs in the northbound lane. It was late afternoon when they rolled up Woodward Avenue in Detroit. The city was stacked up in a hot, close grid, and the summer lay heavy over it. The ruinous decade had scarred the city, as it had every other. Poor boxes on the street, people living in rail cars. Near the intersection of Woodward and 8 Mile Road, there was a cemetery. Pollard and Yummy called for the driver to stop. On the other side of the avenue stood the gate to a racetrack, the Detroit Fairgrounds. Pollard and Yummy hopped down, turned their backs to the gravestones, and walked in. Across the track, Tom Smith was leaning against the easternmost barn, turning a straw in his teeth. In the stall behind him was Seabiscuit. Smith had been sitting by the horse for 2 days, thinking on him, watching him, trying to inhabit him. Something rattled in the horse's mind that made him edgy and angry. He had been enjoying a reign of terror since they had brought him to Detroit, trying to take big chunks out of the grooms, and no one wanted to go within a pitchfork's length of him. No man had ever understood him, and the horse now turned against anyone who tried. Smith was thinking that he needed a strong and intuitive jockey for this one. Up the backstretch, Yummy was zigging and zagging his way through barns with his big paw out, booming his pitch. "Name's Yummy, not Dummy," and coming out empty-handed. No one wanted Pollard. He and Pollard were dirty and tired and shaky from the wreck. Evening was falling, and it was time to start thinking about where to get their next meal and bed down for the night. The bottle of Bow Wow wine was probably long dry. A groom pointed to a gray man sitting in front of the barn where the Howard horses were kept. Agent and jockey turned east and walked toward Smith. Yummy reloaded and made a run at him. Smith waved him off, eyeing the redhead and retrieving a name from years back. Cougar. He recalled the grave lines of the jockey's profile from the days when they had crossed